think the thing that people miss about blockchain technology is they instantly think crypto, and the sort of unlearning that has to happen there is it's really about breaking apart the foundational structures of society and rebuilding them in more decentralized ways.
Welcome to the Unlearn Podcast, where host Barry O'Reilly seeks to synthesize the superpowers of extraordinary individuals to think big, start small, and learn fast. Here's your host, Barry O'Reilly.
Welcome to the Unlearn Podcast. On this show, I'm delighted to be joined by Anne Connolly, a person passionate about harnessing blockchain and decentralized technology to transform the lives of people in emerging economies. Now, I've known Anne for many years, as we're both faculty at Singularity University. She's also faculty at Boston University and Oxford University, where she teaches people about blockchain-based business models. She's the author of Bitcoin for Future of Fundraising, which guides people through charities and crypto donations. She's worked for Médecins Frontières in the Central African Republic and DRC or Congo. I get to ask her lots of questions all the time from our time together at Singularity. She's been working in this space since 2012 and has deep knowledge and expertise. So on this show, it's great to go through her journey about understanding her own path and her entry into understanding and leveraging blockchain and cryptocurrency as a technology and tool for herself and others. So before we go on to what she's doing, let's hear how it got started for her.
There's no question there's a single moment that changed everything. Essentially, I'd been working in the nonprofit space for almost 10 years, didn't like what I was doing anymore, wanted out, but didn't know what to move into, and learned about crypto, got really excited about it, and then essentially got offered a huge promotion in the nonprofit space. I would have been, 28 with 20 employees and $60 million in budget. And I had to have this moment where I'm like, do I give up this promotion for a job in an industry that virtually doesn't exist? This was 2014, maybe, an industry that doesn't exist barely, with a job that didn't exist that I might have to hunt down in some other city. And in the end, I said I would rather try and fail than never have tried at all. And it's been the foundation of pretty much everything that I've done. If you're okay with failing, then you're going to reach great heights, because one of those risks is going to pay off.
It's funny, when I have a lot of people on this show, they generally sort of have a little bit of that mindset, which is good, right? Where they see uncertainty as opportunity. They see things that are new or novel as something to be explored and with only upside to gain. So how did you develop that in yourself? And tell us a little bit more about that opportunity that came your way that sort of triggered that moment.
Yeah, I'd been working for several years at this point for Doctors Without Borders, which is an international aid organization. I had worked in the fundraising department, and a job came up that was the director of that department. And on paper, I had absolutely everything they needed to do the job. And I knew that if I applied, I would get it. And I sort of just had this gut feeling, like I just couldn't really get the application in. I wasn't motivated to do it, and I let it go. And then it was sort of this moment where I'm like, well, if I'm not going to apply to this, then I better get my butt in gear for whatever else it is I'm going to be doing. Because that was sort of the pinnacle of my job and my career trajectory at that point in time. And so I started really hustling. I said, you know what? I don't like the job I'm in. So by my, 2-year anniversary in that position, I was going to have a different job. Here's how I was going to do it. I was going to reach out to different people every day. I was going to message all the companies that I liked. I was super proactive about it. And then that job had gone through one round of hiring, didn't find anyone. They went through another round of hiring, didn't find anyone. And finally, the third round came around, and the executive director of the organization hunted me down and said, you need to come apply for this. So it was almost a guaranteed position. And I debated it, and I was so tired, and I applied. And then a week later, I withdrew my application. And so it really was this pivotal moment, this extreme amount of stress making that decision. But it was hands down the best decision I ever could have made, because, that job wasn't going anywhere. And there were 100 jobs just like it at 100 different organizations that I could have gotten. I didn't care about what I was working on anymore. I wasn't going to be happy. And so, you know, I would rather struggle in some other position or trying to hustle something on the side that I loved. It would be way better off. I would be way happier. And that's what ended up happening. I was longer to get out of the industry than I wanted. But, you know, I worked in crypto on the side. I had a startup that I did while I was working full time in a nonprofit, but I was so happy and it was worth it for sure.
That is such a hard place for so many people to work their way through. Like, I always love hearing sort of the honesty of people who have really been to a difficult sort of like the rock and the hard place type scenario, right? Where, yeah, for so much of your career to that point, I'd been focused around probably landing a job like that, right? And then the moment comes and yet it sort of feels hollow. As you're starting to explore, though, in the same time, this new sort of exciting path of what could cryptocurrency or that technology mean, especially for someone in fundraising and finance in nonprofit area, like that's a fascinating sort of technology innovation that's happening that has a lot of effect, right? So how did you decide to then start playing around with the startup? Because I think it's also a really important part of making these like high stakes decisions is that you have experience in the other options. So do the classic stick with the fundraising position, be very senior, or I start experimenting and playing around in these other intellectual interest areas or whatever they might be, yet you chose one. So how did you make the first steps there? Because many people, I don't know, maybe they're working in a finance job and they'd love to be a painter or somebody who's like doing something totally different. People struggle to like, you know, and they're left hollow in some respects, right? And it's hard to do. So tell us a little bit about how you started that process and even the start as well, because believe me, I think we both know if you can make up any stat, 90% of startups don't work, but man, you get so much out of them from a learning perspective.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to understand where I was at that moment, you know, I was an MBA grad, super A-type, super ladder climber, doing all the right things. So the idea that I got into startups at all is kind of crazy when I think back on it. But, you know, again, this was sort of 2014. I was going to crypto meetups in Toronto, which was a huge hub for crypto at the time. Super, the depth of knowledge in the developer space at that point in time was incredible. And it was, you know, me and 12 guys in hoodies at these different meetups that we'd go to and just talk about crypto. And I was so confused, but I loved it. I loved it. It was, you know, Wednesday nights. And by Thursday, I was like, is it Wednesday again? You know, and at one of these meetups, I ended up running into someone that I had gone to school with. And he was in the space now. And he said, oh, you know, like, let's talk. I'm thinking about doing this startup. And the whole plan was to do a crypto-based corridor for remittances between the Philippines and Canada, which is a pretty significant remittance corridor. And, you know, of course, the fees on Western Union are 8 to 12%. It's not great for the individuals receiving the money. And so that was the plan. And I look back on that company now and it was hilarious how bad it was. Absolutely hilarious. But, you know, we built out this set of rails and then we actually went down to the Toronto Filipino Festival and we're trying to onboard users. And we had this promotion where I got a whole bunch of Philippine cash and we were handing out, you know, little bills to be like, come sign up for our application. And in the end, I think like I got lucky because this guy had done startups before, although I think I thought he was maybe more knowledgeable than he was. He actually was living on my couch for 8 weeks while we built this thing out in a one bedroom apartment.
Yeah, I love it.
So I would go to work for, you know, 8 hours and then come home and we'd work on this. And in the end, I think his visions were enormous. He wanted to replace, you know, the traditional banking networks. And I just didn't know what was going on. But I did. I learned so much. He put me in touch with like the Stanford Startup School, which are all these YouTube videos about how to run a startup. And he went over to the Philippines and I just sort of thought, like, this is not it. This is not working, or it's, I don't, you know, and ended up sort of pulling the plug on it, which is a good thing. You know, and my father gave me really good advice. He said, you know, your co-founders might go on to build a hugely successful company and, you know, you can be happy for him and maybe you'll be sad that you didn't stay involved, but you can only make the decision based on the information you have today. And right now it's not looking so good. And he was right. It didn't materialize. It was too early for the market, but I learned so much. And that, I think, also fed into that transition between the regular world to the startup world, where you're working on stuff for no money. You don't know what's going to happen to it. You're, balancing personalities and hustle and what all that looks like. And so it was a really safe training ground, I think, for getting a lot of that experience, which was great and really helped me as I've moved forward.
Yeah, right on. Like, unfortunately, I'm going to empathize with you every time on this. I'm sure there's plenty of listeners who are like, that's crazy. Why did you do that? But, for me, all the greatest personal growth moments have been doing exactly what you described. It's like putting yourself outside your comfort zone, betting on the possibility. Like, there's a million reasons you can rationalize your life out of doing anything uncertain, but there's just so much upside there for people when you put yourself in these sort of places. The stories you're left with as well are also brilliant for whenever you're out in cocktail bars and, want to tell people what it's like to be in a startup. But again, like, you learn so much, right? And it is hard, even then again, to like walk away from them. There's so many times, like, again, these tough decisions where you have to use the information you've gathered from the experience to say, sure, this could go on and become the greatest thing ever, but how am I feeling about it right now? And backing yourself to make another tough decision to walk away, it's really hard to do that. But it builds this sort of muscle, I feel like, where you start to be able to sense in highly uncertain spots a trust and belief in yourself to actually back your intuition and the information that you're gathering from it. And that's really hard for many people to ever do. But I feel like when you go put yourselves in these places, you actually start to build competency in this and do it. So tell us then what happened next, right? So obviously your co-founder, they got booted off the couch and you were like, great, finally I can watch Netflix and chill. I'm sure that didn't happen. So what happened after that? What were some of your next, obviously there's a huge passion for cryptocurrency in the blockchain space. So how did you keep evolving your interest in that area and sort of developing all this competency you have in it now?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing I did was cry.
Oh, good. Yeah, that was good. Pick them out, then cry, and then let's go again. Let's go again. Right. Good.
I think a part of the thing that I realized too is maybe I was trying to use that startup or that project as a rocket ship out of what I was doing already. And when that failed, it was like, oh, I'm left here on Earth and I don't want to be here. And so I think that's also something that I've learned is really recognizing, like, do you love this project or are you using it as an escape vehicle for what you're already doing? But from there, I ended up getting a job doing marketing for this crypto company called Decentral that was sort of the main crypto hub in Toronto at the time. And I was just thrilled. I knew it was going to be tough. Because again, startup world, totally different. Someone had to sit me down and teach me how to use Slack. Like, I knew nothing about this world. And it was short-lived. I was only there for 3 months. And then I got scooped up by another company doing crypto stuff. At that point in time, the crypto space was not well-developed. Like, I knew all of the companies that existed in the entire industry. And I was a non-coder. I was business, I was strategy, communications, which all of those companies needed, but none of them knew they needed.
Yep, right.
So,
on.
Know, to find a position as a non-technical person was the challenge. But from there, ended up applying for Singularity University's Global Solutions Program, which essentially, if you haven't heard of Singularity, it's this incredible think tank where the whole premise is teaching people how to use technology to solve some of the world's greatest challenges. So some of our big global issues like healthcare, water, climate change. And it was really the first time I'd seen my two passions mixed together. So when I worked in, the charitable nonprofit world, the impact world, everyone was really great about the impact, but nobody wanted to incorporate technology. And when I got into the technology world with crypto, everyone was great with the tech, but nobody really cared about changing the world with it. And this really was the first time I'd met this community of people that were like, hey, we care about these big issues, but we're really not okay with how we've been trying to solve them for the past 100 years. There are better ways. And so learned all about VR, AI, we learned about nanotech, biotech, all this stuff, and how you can actually use these technologies to create 10 times more impact instead of sort of this 10% better that I was used to from my time in the nonprofit sector. And that really was a pivotal moment in changing the way that I think about how to do everything. literally everything in my life has changed as a result of, okay, well, we could make this a little bit better, but why? When if we completely transformed it and, you know, used technology, that we could make such a difference that it wouldn't be worth doing the other solution at all. And I think that, again, comes back to a little bit of my risk tolerance, which was higher at that point from doing the startup world and the crypto space. But I look at problems now with a totally different lens, and it's helped change the way I think.
Yeah, no, obviously Singularity is where we both met. And like, it's a very fascinating place, right? Just the characters that float around there are a certain type of ilk, and one that I really, really enjoy. Who do also have, as you say, this idea of real problems and then thinking about how to apply technology to really accelerate solutions. And that's what always really inspired me about being around people like that, right? They generally are coming from a well-meaning place, and they're looking at ways to make things better. That program as well, like so many people who've been through that specific program, a lot of them describe it as a transformational experience in their life to be put in a sort of cross-functional world of people from various different backgrounds all over the world, but they sort of learning about these technologies together, right? And I think anytime I certainly am at Singularity and maybe we're doing one of these exec programs, or people come in with this sort of, you see it on their face on the first day, they have just sort of excitement or maybe anxiety or whatever. Why am I here? My boss told me I had to go, whatever it is. But like the outpour of positivity and excitement and camaraderie that seems to happen after these people spend a week together and they're exposed to a lot of people sharing like what is the path of travel for these new technologies, you specifically obviously around blockchain cryptocurrency, it's just a really nice place to be. I always find, even when I feel like the world is falling apart and there's wars all over the place and AI is going to turn into Terminator and take me out, I always feel the opposite when I like leave a week of an executive program with Singularity, because people are really showing some great examples of what's happening. So maybe that could be a good point for you to share, right? Like you are like as deep as anyone I know in this space, and people are probably thinking a lot about what this technology means. And I think you have a great grasp of it to help them understand that. So what are some of the true innovations you're most excited about? And then a chance for people to unlearn a little bit about this technology and what it means for the world, whether it's how decisions are made, how people's identity is managed, how they can actually start to take more ownership of their technology sort of footprint. Can you share a little bit around that, some of the things you're most excited about?
Yeah, I think the thing that people miss about blockchain technology is they instantly think crypto, and the sort of unlearning that has to happen there is it's really about breaking apart the foundational structures of society and rebuilding them in more decentralized ways. And so some of the unlearning I've had to do is really around this idea that the way we've built our society is good and it's static and it's not going to change. So, you know, you can think about structures like money, you can think about structures like governance system, who makes decisions, what it means to be a human being within our society is stuff that we've just sort of taken for granted or taken as being good. And I think more and more we're maybe seeing that, hey, these systems are actually not working for a huge proportion of the world. You know, I get people around Bitcoin in particular that say, well, why would I ever want money that isn't backed by government? And I say, well, you know, you're American, you probably wouldn't want money that isn't backed by government. But like, let's take a look at the population in Venezuela, where their inflation rate is hit at 1.53 million%, and everyone's life savings went up in smoke, and people were eating garbage as a means to stay alive because their money wasn't worth anything. Can you imagine a world where they might need Bitcoin? Then it starts to, you know, people, oh yeah, well, that makes sense. I could see that. And then you can sort of extrapolate from there about maybe the monetary systems that we've created aren't actually as sound as we thought they were. Or maybe they are for us, but maybe not for 4 billion people around the world that struggle with hyperinflation. But it goes so much further beyond that. And I think one of the topics I'm most curious about this day and age is really this idea of governance and how do we make decisions as large groups? Because the internet has brought all these different people together to coordinate and collaborate in a way that wasn't previously possible. So we have this governance system where, you know, it was created at a time where someone had to get on a horse to go and represent their village in the central city and then ride, you know, 4 days back. And it hasn't changed a whole lot since. Does that work in today's world? You know, maybe not so much. And so one of the cool things that's come out in the blockchain space is something called a DAO or DAO or Decentralized Autonomous Organization. And really, it's not actually as complicated as it sounds. It's really just a group of people who have a common goal for something they want to achieve together and are able to do that with no hierarchies or few hierarchies because they're able to use sort of the trust that blockchains provide. So let's say you have one group that wants to plant a community garden. Well, all of them can donate cryptocurrency to a, you know, a jointly held wallet, and anyone from that group can submit a proposal for maybe what flowers that they want to include. Everyone can vote on it. All the votes are transparent. And then once the vote is complete, it auto-triggers deposit of crypto into the person who's going to actually do that job. That's a very basic example, but there are DAOs that are, you know, trying to solve climate change. There are DAOs that are huge venture capital funds with, you know, over $4 billion in assets that have money flowing from all over the world. Like, I think one of my favorite examples of a DAO was Constitution DAO, which essentially this group of people realized that a copy of the US Constitution was going up for auction. They thought, you know, it's really crazy that one rich guy is going to own a copy of this document that governs so many of us. And within, I think it was about 48 hours, they collectively brought together 17,000 people who each donated, you know, a small amount of money. I can't remember what the average donation was, but it was, you know, somewhere less than $100. And they pulled together about $40 million for this fund to collectively buy and own this copy of the Constitution. And if you think about trying to do that without crypto and without these sort of decentralized governance mechanisms, these proposal systems, et cetera, that are transparent and on chain, I mean, I just don't think it would be possible. How are you going to get 17,000 bank transfers and then trust one person as the signatory on that account is not going to like run off with it? And so this is where I'm most excited, is the speed within which you can collectively organize huge numbers of people, manage enormous amounts of money to achieve these goals that, you know, when you think about global cooperation in particular, like if you wanted to do Constitution DAO, maybe in the United States, you could say, okay, Venmo this address. We're going to hope this guy doesn't run off with the money. But what if someone from, you know, Africa or China or Australia wanted to contribute? How are they going to do that? They can't, you know, you're not going to send a $20 donation that costs you $30 to send. It doesn't make sense. And so when we look at how corporations are run, how nonprofits are run, even how governments are run, this new decentralized model that we're sort of testing out in the crypto space, I think shows a lot of promise for a new way to completely organize human beings to achieve their collective goals.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating. And for me anyway, extremely efficient, right? Like using technology to allow, as you say, the Constitution DAO is a great example, right? To people organize around a mission that they believe in, contribute, be able to vote, be able to propose things, be able to get feedback on changes in a very short period of time and actually, you know, have trust and auditability of it. It's fascinating. You know, one of the things that was so funny when we were starting the venture studio, one of the steps we did is we obviously were trying to raise capital through a crowdfunding mechanism, right? We did equity crowdfunding. And for me, that is sort of like this stepping stone place that many people are still trying to get their head around. Like, how could you let retail investors invest in early stage startups? They're not allowed to do it. The government won't let them. You have to be a multimillionaire. Then you are trusted that you're allowed to invest. And our lowest investment was like $100. And even then, we had to go through the same level of governance that you do with the SEC when you're going to do an IPO, just to do an offering to invest in the startup. And it was legions of paperwork, hours of lawyers, endless communication. You know, this for me was like this sort of even creating a small stepping stone where you could have open up the population that could actually invest and own a piece of an early stage startup, right? 50% of our investments in our equity crowdfunding were $100. from 55 different countries around the world. It was so nice to like look at the list of countries where like it's a US incorporated corporation, but 55 countries outside of that from anywhere across Africa, Asia, people were putting in $100, you know, and it was so, so hard to make that opportunity happen. And even then as this sort of stepping stone, you know, and so much of the thing that kept striking me as we were going through the process is, imagine we could do this as a DAO. Yet the challenge is, because this is a new technology that is unfamiliar to folks, is that you're shrinking the population essentially then that could access that right at the moment. Tell us a little bit about like the on-ramp for this, because you're also seeing that starting to happen, right? Like, I obviously live in the Philippines at the moment, so I loved your first Philippines story. There's the highest proportion of crypto wallets in the world here in this country, which is, again, a lot of it is people repatriating money back to the country. But tell us a little bit more about how we start to get more people in this world, or to your own life experience, experimenting a little bit to take a low stakes way of starting to have a high sort of return on what they're learning, and regardless of the price element, which again, I think is a misnomer. So to tell us a little bit more about how we get there. How do we get more people experimenting with DAOs, understanding them as a society, to get like a real taste of it?
This is the challenge, is that everything in crypto, all the promise, all the decentralized ID, all of the DAOs, like anything that you're going to do using blockchain pretty much at the moment, requires the base knowledge of how to have a wallet, buy crypto, and store crypto safely. And that really is this hurdle that people have to get over. And the challenge that I've seen, I think, is there's a huge amount of fear where most people are not really willing to dabble. They're very risk averse or very against it. I don't want Bitcoin. Why would, you know, I'm not doing that. You know, I remember sitting at a table. It was myself and about seven kind of older white gentlemen who were, I don't want Bitcoin. And I said, well, why don't I just, I'll help you set up a wallet right now. I'll transfer you $1 with the Bitcoin. We'll do it right now. And we did it. I did it with one guy. There was one guy who was like, yeah, okay, that's good. And then once he had it, all the rest, oh, I want that. I want some of that. And so we went around the table, got them all set up. By the end of the evening, oh, I parted Bitcoin. I have Bitcoin. Do you have Bitcoin? And they were just so excited to now be part of this community. But that's sort of the maybe best way to change minds, I think, is really to say, hey, you're not on the outside anymore. You're on the inside. But the challenge is, how do you do that en masse? How do you do that at scale? And my pure and simple opinion on this, and it's not a popular one within the crypto space, is that we need more integration with social trends to do that. So one of the greatest onboarding tools for crypto in, I think it was roughly 2017, was CryptoKitties, which are these kind of Tamagotchi-like digital cats that people could buy and breed and take care of and sell. And there were many ICOs, many sort of these coin offerings that were happening around that time that had to postpone themselves because so many people were buying and selling these digital cats that the network was a bit backed up. And so the same thing around these kind of meme NFTs and sports memorabilia and all this stuff that in some way you could say is not maybe as serious or as meaningful as, you know, some of the more society breaking elements that crypto is bringing. It's the on-ramp that is going to get the general population over the hump of, sorry, getting a wallet and buying some crypto. And I don't think we recognize that enough in the blockchain space. We spend a lot of time fighting for slices of the same pie instead of, you know, working collaboratively to grow that pie, you know, amongst different user sets. But what we are seeing, as you sort of alluded to, was this adoption in places where crypto solves a real problem for people. So, you know, in the States, Western Europe, most people are buying crypto as sort of a speculative asset, or it's interesting, or diversify their portfolio. But where we're seeing high levels of retail adoption is, you know, Western Africa, Nigeria, Thailand, Argentina, South Africa, places where, again, people can't quite trust the government to run a financial system, or they don't have access to banking because they're too poor, or, you know, there aren't banks readily accessible near their towns. And I think that's what gives me the most hope and excitement about this technology, is that really and truly it is reaching the populations where it's going to create massive amounts of change on those people's lives.
Yeah, no, right on. It's funny. You take me back to one of my first ever startups was a mobile games development company. And this was just at the time when wireless application protocol, which is sort of the forerunner for what people would use now for just connectivity between phones, was launched. So phones could communicate with each other over the internet. It was like game changer at the time. And the first product we built was called Wireless Pets, which you basically kept an animal alive on your phone with your friends by feeding it and playing with it. And like the game went absolutely gangbusters. Like it was the most popular game across Europe at the time. It got us funding, and we had Sony and Sega and Disney ringing us up to like help them learn how to build these like mobile applications, you know. And it's so funny, like as you share that story, it constantly reminds me that we need these as on-ramps, right? And they aren't always necessarily in the someone wrote a user journey, said, I wake up one morning, I decided to get a crypto wallet and buy cryptocurrency and then start to use it to transact. Like, that's not how people live their lives. You know, they're brought into things because there's something fun, there's an excitement about it, there's a community and a buzz around it, right? And I never would have thought when we built Wireless Pets of someone like feeding a cat like five times a day would actually make people want to build mobile apps, and literally Disney ring us up to build the Lilo and Stitch game like 3 months later. Like, that was not how the plan looked when we were launching yeah. this thing. And yet, like, that's how these things happen, you know? So yeah, there's so much merit in that, and just encouraging people to try, right? Like, I think that is a huge lesson as I listen to your own story, whether it's like turning down the traditional classic job and sort of choosing a non-obvious path, you know, there's a lot of reward to be done in that. And no matter what, you're going to learn a bunch from doing it.
Yeah, it's been an incredible ride, that's for sure. I mean, I think in terms of getting more people into the crypto and blockchain space, you know, there's a great saying that's, you know, nobody's shouting out loud saying, I really need decentralized money, you know, nobody needs that. Nobody wants that, or they don't know they need it. It's really about looking at, yeah, what are those on-ramps? How do we get more people involved? And just getting a more diverse group of people building in the space, I think, is also a really critical point that we probably don't focus on enough as well.
Just to close then, what would be your advice for folks then to start exploring this domain? Like, how do they get started? What can they do? What are your sort of tips to start small, even though they might think big about the opportunity and this technology and how it might affect them?
My biggest piece of advice is always don't invest your money in crypto, invest your time. And so go spend an evening learning about how to get a wallet, how to buy a dollar's worth of Bitcoin. You don't need to go and buy, you know, drop your life savings into it. And then, you know, if you buy your dollar and it goes up, that's great. If it goes down, well, you know, you spent an evening on it and it was interesting to learn it, and you can see how it works. So you haven't really lost anything. And from there, if you think it might solve a problem for you, or you think it may be easier to use than you thought it might have been, then you're off to the races. You're already there. And so that really is when you take away the financial pressure of investing in crypto and just say, just do it for an hour. See if you can figure out in the next hour, would that be worth trying something new? Most people are open to doing that. And that's where I'd say people should start.
Right on. Super and stellar advice as ever. Great to always catch up, have you on the show, and thanks for sharing your fascinating life story. There's no many twists and turns ahead, I'm sure. And I'm sure we'll have you back on the show again. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that show, but I'm even more delighted to share the exciting news. I've recently co-founded a new venture studio named Nobody Studios. Now, Venture Studio is a vehicle for the rapid creation of new companies, from ideation to acceleration and growth. And our purpose at Nobody Studios will be to de-risk pre-seed stage business ideas. We'll do this by minimizing the time, speed, and capital involved in validating truly repeatable and scalable business models before any significant venture investment. We've an audacious goal:
to start 100 compelling companies over the next 5 years, and who knows how many beyond that. So if you're interested in radically changing the way work is done, how products are created, companies built and funded, even democratizing the wealth creation and how returns are distributed, this could be the business for you. We're looking for talent, capital, and influence. If you wish to contribute any or all of these, just get in touch. You can follow us on nobodystudios.com, on our LinkedIn page, all the social media accounts, or simply my newsletters and what I'm sharing. We'll be launching a truly innovative crowdfunding campaign, and I'd be honored if you'd be willing to join us on this journey and become a nobody yourself.